Yeah, having my head shoved into the steps of the Ulster Bank in Ranelagh, cold butt of a gun put into the back of your skull. That's a moment where you go, okay, yeah, I think this one's up.
How does a high-flying academic become one of Ireland's most prolific bank robbers?
What I would see as the most important part of this still lies open.
I'm Not Here to Hurt You, a brand new series from the award-winning team behind the Indo Daily.
That November day, that's where it all begins.
Out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Seachtain, an Indo as Gaeilge.
Time I mon iarracht I aon of chacht ar a chur, agus suilgam a machan seo, gur féidir é a chur in uig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltí, fís, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhéadach ara I gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gináim go raibh orthchar an reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthchar san I lis dúthail agus gimine fnacht gór a chlig sár ducha sin éachar. Ná ní bhín ann dár dárach sin, bhín marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Hello and you're welcome to The Big Tech Show with me, Adrian Wack, the tech editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent. And this week we're talking about Twitter bots, and it's in the context of a row that's been going on in Ireland over so-called pro-government bots or politicised bots. Now I'm going to be talking to Damien Mully, who is a digital marketing consultant and who consults on social media strategy and gives a lot of classes on that, and founder of Mully Communications. But first, let me just read to you how we cover this issue in The Independent. And as I said, there has been this row going on because in recent days there have been claims that pro-government bots have been deployed to laud ministers' response to the pandemic. And Health Minister Simon Harris in particular has been on the receiving end of a large amount of praise online for his efforts to halt the spread of the disease. And this has prompted claims among some Twitter users that fake accounts are promoting the government. And by fake accounts, what we mean is accounts with few followers, no profile picture, or which have a series of numbers in the username and have made positive comments about the government response. Now, they've been accused of being so-called bots. And by bots, the implication is that they're users who maybe were long dormant or who only set up since the virus emergency started, and have also been on the receiving end of speculation that they're automated. The allegations are often accompanied by the hashtags LeoBots or ConCannonBots. And ConCannonBots refers to the public relations guru John Concannon, who was brought back by Leo Varadkar. And ConCannon was originally part of what is sometimes deemed a controversial and now defunct strategic communications unit to manage the government's public information campaign on the coronavirus. Now, Twitter has actually responded on this. It came back to a few queries that we had on it, and it said that it was kind of a bland response, but it did address the issues in some way. It said, "We're focused on protecting the public conversation and helping people find authoritative sources of information, blah, blah, blah. Our specialist teams investigated and do not see evidence of extensive politicized bots amplifying narratives on the pandemic conversation in Ireland." And it went on to say, "In recent weeks, we've seen more and more new people joining Twitter to follow what's happening and find the authoritative information they need. But having no profile photo or having a numbered handle or username does not mean an account is automated. It often just means it's new." And then it provided a link to a blog post about that. Damien Mully, a digital marketing consultant and founder of Mully Communications. Can you talk me through an idiot-proof guide here of what is a bot?
Okay, sure. So a bot is, I guess, a piece of software, and you get that piece of software to do things for you. So in the context of Twitter, you could program a bot, which is a Twitter account, to like certain updates, respond with comments to certain updates, or go and search for hashtags and retweet those or comment on those. And it's all automated. So you program them, but it goes off and does the rest for you. You set it off, and off it goes.
And that's their main purpose on Twitter. And I mean, we've heard an awful lot about bots in connection with, you know, Russia and Putin and in interfering in elections. On Twitter, who uses them primarily?
Most of the time, it's spammers. So, for example, if you tweet out anything around Bitcoin or certain social media phrases, or even Elon Musk, what you'll find within seconds is that you'll get these weird Twitter accounts responding to you, retweeting you, or trying to sell you some sort of Bitcoin product themselves.
Mm.
And so what they do, those bots, is they monitor Twitter for certain things, and then they respond to you. So it's mostly used by spammers or actually crooks a lot of the time now, trying to get you to sign up for things through fake PayPals and fake Stripes and things like that.
Mm. And if you're suspicious, how can you tell, or how can you check, or is there any way of checking that it is a bot?
Well, I guess that's why some people are thinking these positive comments, which I think are from genuine people, are bots, because the usernames are weird. They're random names. They might be like parts of a Christian name and then lots of numbers after them, or lots of X's and Y's just thrown in randomly. That's one way of spotting them. But actually, one of the main ways of seeing are they bots is look at how many tweets that they're sending out. Mm. And a lot of these bots send out tweets every 4 or 5 minutes. And if you look at the account itself, they're responding to thousands of people per day with the exact same phrase an awful lot of the time.
Mm, I see, yeah. And but is there any way that you can actually go in and check in any more definitive way? Let's say you look at an account. People do tweet a lot sometimes during the day, particularly in a crisis or a pandemic crisis. And let's say that they're not the identical tweet. Is there any other way that you can go in, if you really wanted to do some investigation, to check whether or not something was a bot or not?
Yeah, so one of the easiest things, and everyone can do it, is when you look at the Twitter account, you go onto Twitter and you do a password reset and you put in their username.
Mm.
And Twitter will say, is this you? And it'll give you a partial segment of the email address behind the account or the mobile number behind the account. And if it's a mobile number, that means that it's attached to a mobile. And if you're meant to be running a bot army of thousands of accounts, you can't really connect each one of those to an individual mobile.
So that's a good sign that it's not a bot, if it comes back a mobile number.
Yeah, it means that they've verified with a mobile number. Mm. And the other way then is when you look at the email address, you can see partial, like the first couple of letters of the email address. And so if it's John Murphy 27398, if you look at the email address, a lot of time you'll see it is John Murphy or the start of J-O-H or something like that. Whereas with the bots, again, an awful lot of time, it'll be just random numbers like XY887. That's the way, because they're after buying random email addresses as well, or fake email addresses.
And might they ever use mainstream email addresses like Gmail or not?
They can use Gmail, but Gmail themselves have anti-spam measures in place, and they check if people are just creating thousands of Gmail accounts. So they might get away with it for maybe an hour, creating thousands of fake Gmail accounts or real Gmail accounts for dodgy purposes, but they'll be deleted within an hour or two. And Twitter does the same actually with a lot of these bots. They can see fake accounts being created, and they get destroyed or deleted every couple of hours.
Mm. And to somebody who's maybe not as literate as you in looking at this, why are there legitimate random number usernames? Like, you will see people and they'll have no profile picture. They'll just have the egg there. And then they'll have, you know, John Murphy, you know, 9,271 or whatever. Why is that? Why is that happening?
So Twitter allows the username to be 15 characters at most. And in a way, they've run out of good usernames. So Twitter almost allows you to create a vanity username, like a vanity number plate. And so they get used up. And so what Twitter is doing now is, if you're John Murphy and you want the username John Murphy, it's gone. So what they're suggesting now is they just give you a username and you can go back in later on and change that username if it's available. So everyone now is getting that random jumble of letters at the end of their username, because the main thing Twitter found and Facebook found for years is the time it takes to get your account set up will put an awful lot of people off. So if you can't get your account set up within 5 minutes now, you just lose interest. And so they were losing an awful lot of people. So now it's really quick to get your account sorted and off you go tweeting or following people.
Do you know, sometimes I'm envious of people who got in really, really early and got their own name. I mean, I have used my own name, Adrian Weckler, but there is some guy in the UK, in Leicester or somewhere, who got Adrian, and he just got in like really early, I think in 2006. There are other people. There's a, you know him, there's an entrepreneur called Pat Phelan in Cork. He got Pat, P-A-T. I'm not sure if he was just in super early on that or not. Yeah. But I guess it's almost impossible to get those names anymore.
I'm the same. There's a username, Damien, and he works in Google, and he seems to tweet about once or twice a year,
Same with Adrian.
It kills you.
I know. He's wasting such valuable resources. Can you buy and sell a Twitter name?
You can, and I think their terms and conditions actually allow that. Huh. So you can, and there is some marketplaces for that. Hmm. Or sometimes it's just trying to approach the person that holds the account and ask them, like, to sell it or send it on to you. But an awful lot of time, those accounts are dormant. And when you go in and do the password reset, even their email address has been closed down. So it's very hard to get access to those accounts. Twitter used to allow it years back that you'd kind of send a begging letter to Twitter and the reasons for it. And they'd maybe hand over that username. But that doesn't seem to be happening anymore.
You see it with some media organizations as well. I mean, I used to work in the Sunday Business Post. And I remember I was responsible for revamping the Business Post website about 8 or 9 years ago. And part of that was, you know, creating a proper Twitter account and everything. But they changed the name from the Sunday Business Post to the Business Post recently. But obviously Business Post has been long gone. So I think they went with Business Post HQ. You'll see things like HQ or The Real, you know, added to something.
Or underscore IE for a lot of ones, but I don't think that works properly.
We did that. I've been working The Independent for a few years, and when Twitter really kicked off The Independent, I chose independent underscore daddy, and it has always kind of seemed a little bit, if we just sort of done something slightly, but whatever, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think after a while, it may not be as big a barrier to somebody joining or following, but maybe in the first 20 or 30 seconds, it might be, yeah.
Yeah, and it can be. Morning Ireland, I think, had the same problem that when they joined Twitter, someone already had Morning Ireland, and it was kind of almost like a fake Morning Ireland account. Mm. But I think when you do searches nowadays, the real account pops up, so there is that. But I know some people are, you know, I think for new users, you know, you've got the fake Robert De Niro accounts that are just memes all the time. Yeah. I'm sure some people believe it is Robert De Niro being very, very, like, on point on every issue that's happening on Twitter.
Yeah.
But I think for most people, after a while, you understand that's not the real person.
So in this case, I mean, you've had a basic look at what the row is this week. What does it look like they're bots or not?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I think it's new people that are joining, and like I do classes with people of various ages, and it's still very hard to get your head around Twitter and to put up your photograph and things like that. People just want to join Twitter for news, so they're not even tweeting much, and the comments are very, very quaint in terms of people praising the minister and things like that. So they seem real, and I've done the password reset, and the password reset is genuine looking names and a couple of aircom.net accounts as well. So it's real from what I can tell. There are fake accounts out there.
Yeah.
But I think in this aspect, their messaging is different. They're not using the exact same phrase. And it's also like, why would you bother?
That did occur to me. I mean, when you talk about Putin, you talk about China, and you talk about the US, and there are major, you know, policy implications involved, major issues, a lot of money one side or the other. In this issue, just to go on and praise Simon Harris, it seems like a lot of hassle. You say that there are better ways to run a bot army if you want to anyway.
Yeah, especially coming up to like pre-election, you can skew things, you can get things trending, and then the media will pick up going, why is this trending? And they increase the trend as well. Or you can put out like propaganda, and that's not the case here. Just people like praising someone, that's not really propaganda. If it was crazy over-the-top stuff, taking shots at other political parties or governments, then that's one way of using the bot army. Or like some of the bot armies, what they do is they can get someone an awful lot of followers very quickly. And all of a sudden, this person might seem like an authority because they have 300,000 followers on Twitter. But most of them are fake. And again, that doesn't seem to be happening. There's no growth in these accounts from people on the other side of the planet and things like that.
I mean, and also, maybe this is unkind, I'd also question the competence of the people who are being accused of setting up these bots to actually set up a bot army. But that's an entirely different question. I'm sure our lawyers will look over that one.
Yeah. I mean, again, this should have happened. If someone had control of a bot army and things like that, this should have happened before the election and should have been used before the election. And given the election results, it didn't happen.
Yeah, sure. Okay, listen, that was a very helpful explanation, Damien. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Damien Mully, digital marketing consultant and founder of Mully Communications.
Thank you, Adrian.
Now, one of the outcomes of the pandemic is that the event and conference industry has crashed. Events are being cancelled left, right and centre, and people are wondering whether they can replace this with virtual conferences online. Well, my next guest this week has just that idea. He has created an online conferencing platform called Vito, and you can visit it at vito.community. And his name is Paul Campbell, and this is how our conversation went. Paul Campbell, founder of Tito and Vito being a new online conferencing platform. What's the difference between an online conferencing platform and a live stream?
Ah, good question. So an online conferencing platform is something that people who organize in-person events have never considered using before.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is effectively a live stream that is designed for people who are figuring out a new way to survive in amidst the corona crisis.
Okay, and that's a great mission statement, right? So, I mean, for example, some of the key features that you're saying that Vito has, you're saying that it has a sponsor offers area, for example, a presenter area. You can offer integrated access and invitations. So, I mean, if I try and visualize this, because I know you did have an event a few days ago, you trialed it, and I think you got a couple of hundred people into it?
No, we have a couple hundred people in our waiting list. So there was about 80 people at the event.
Okay. And what did that look like? I mean, what physically did it look like for the attendees?
Right. I've been saying that it's sort of like either a multi-headed beast mashup of YouTube, a live agenda.
Did you just say YouTube?
Twitter.
You say YouTube.
Yeah, sorry, YouTube.
Yeah, we are still yeah. Irish. Yeah. No, sorry, I'm jesting.
I'm sorry. That's I really much appreciate you pulling me out on that. I should put all my Irish accent if this is for the Irish people.
It's for anyone. But anyway,
because I got so used to speaking to American people, and then if I say that my name is Paul Campbell, they don't know what Campbell is. It's Campbell.
Oh, Campbell. So, I mean, we're all a little bit guilty of that. Campbell. I hear myself doing that as well. Like, even as we speak, I am conscious that I'm about 20% more pukey mid-Atlantic accent than I normally would be. And I know that is because I'm on a podcast. I do the same when I'm radio. On radio, it's even worse sometimes, especially TV.
Right.
If you ever see me on a TV clip, which is thankfully not that often, sometimes it's absolutely appalling. I mean, I'll go full Casey Kasem, right? As in, you know, well, Miriam, the thing about the national broadband plan, like it's like listening to Mark Little, you know?
Right.
I mean, Mark Little, if Mark is listening, Mark has the reference voice for Irish broadcasting of a certain era for men. And I'm not slagging it off at all. I'm just saying that psychologically, at some point, it has kind of somehow leached down into the back of the brains of us lesser journalists that is an aspirational thing. And therefore, you know, I listen to myself and I say, oh, Christ almighty, are you trying to be like Mark Little? I don't know. I'm sure he'd be.
I love that we're 2 minutes in and we're already delving into the depths of insecure journalist psychology.
There's a lot more where that came from. But anyway, we were actually talking about Vito there, and we're talking about features, and we're talking about what, for example, attendees at a live event, what they would see in front of them. Because, You know, you and I have been trying whereby, you know, you and I and the rest of the world have been trying things like Zoom, not trying, but we've been using them, you know, or Teams or Hangouts. And so we're all familiar with the basic crude layout of that kind of web meetup. Right. So what, how does this differ? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's got the video, obviously. And instead of under the video being there being comments or whatever, under the video is your agenda. So who's speaking, what they're speaking about, what's up next, what's been on already. And this is very much taking the live event paradigm and shoveling it in a nice little elegant way. Mm. Although I'll get later that I think that the live event is going to change because of all this, but we can talk about that. Mm. And then there's a little browser, a little section browser, which is all the different sections that we've talked about, which is like who's organizing, who's presenting, who's sponsoring, who's here. Mm. And you can click around all of that interactively and the video keeps playing, right? So the video won't get interrupted as you're clicking around. So simple-ish technology, hard to get quite right, but that was critical that you could kind of browse the whole conference. So you can sort of be at the live stream and in the expo hall and in the hallway track all at the same time without losing any context,
so
which I think is important on that.
You're browsing other physical locations that are being filmed at the conference. Is that what you mean when you refer to browsing around or being able to, you know, take a tour?
No, the right-hand side is effectively a Twitter-like feed, and the feed can be filtered by the organizers. It can be filtered by the who's presenting. It could be filtered by who you're following. So you can follow, you can look at what everyone's saying. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to a live stream at the moment and you see, it's either going to be lots of like little hearts or whatever on Periscope, or it's going to be no messages if it's not quiet, or like a gazillion messages flying past and you're never going to be able to follow it. So that's the chat model. And so a lot of conferences have Slack and you go into the conference Slack and it's just so many messages, it's so overwhelming. Mm. But there's a social network out there that does large groups really well, and it's Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me that for a conference setting or a conference setup, Twitter is a much more effective model, at least at the top of it. So you go in and there's a Twitter thing. You can do everything if you want, but then you can choose who you want to follow within the event. Mm. And then you can start to filter things down. So very much a Twitter model in terms of the community side of things now. But that's what we built in the month, was a video player, a live updating agenda, a set of sections that really neatly divide the three key components of commerce at a conference, which is organizers, sponsors, and attendees, and a way to make that nice and simple to jump between them. And then a Twitter-like is what I'm thinking of it now. And that's like the scaffolding of the project, as it were.
There are a lot of events and conferences that have been, you know, nixed or put on ice for either completely cancelled or, you know, put back by 6 months, 8 months, you know, or
yeah,
more.
For example, O'Reilly Media, that have been running the flagship conferences in the technology world for the last 20 years, they've just shit-canned their whole operation. They're not going back. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, and yet at the same time, well, what I was going to ask you about that, about those conferences being delayed, and you're coming in with this idea at maybe a slightly lower level alternative to a giant arena with 20,000, 30,000 people, but nevertheless, you're coming in with this idea. Do you think there's a market? You clearly think there is a market there for that. Are you seeing any evidence, of any other virtual conferences?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a gazillion competitors, and there's always going to be a lot of competitors, and that shows you that there's a market. Competitors are scary things, but in general, if there are no competitors, you should be worried. So there's definitely a market. The other key to there being potential, whether it's a market or whether there's interest, is just uptake and, I guess, external interest. And I can honestly say I've had more interviews with folks like yourself in the last couple of days than in like the last few years.
Well, we got to do something.
Nobody ever had this level of interest in Tito, and I know that it's a response to the coronavirus crisis or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's a different level of optimism here around this project, particularly within the team, within just our energy.
Yeah. Well, you're coming at it with maybe a little bit more energy. So, I mean, I remember, I think I met you maybe about 8 or 9 years ago. I think you were in an accelerator, or maybe it was the NDRC.
Yeah. It was the saddest of all interactions where you wanted me to feature me in a 30 under 30 list, and I was too old.
Okay, right, there you go. You know.
And it was like, sorry.
Yeah, I know. I know, there is that kind of thing where when you're over 30, you're still kind of young, but you're not kind of sexy 30 under 30. Look at this rising young star. I mean, you sort of are. Like when you think of the Collisons, for example, right? Patrick and John. So Patrick is now, yeah. I think he's either just about to turn 30, or he's thereabouts. At that point,
and he's been grey for a few years.
Oh well, yeah. Some pictures show it, maybe some some don't. But at that point, when he turns 30, is he still this unbelievably talented young entrepreneur? Or is he now kind of, he's just a Silicon Valley tech billionaire, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, if you subscribe to this, I think there's a stat out there that to show that like companies started by people in their 50s are like 10 times more likely to succeed than companies started by young people. We like to dwell. I actually attended a few minutes of an online conference, and there was a kid who's 11, and he's contributing to like AI open source libraries, and he's been doing computer science since he was 5, and like there was the chat of the live stream was just like, oh, what am I doing with my life? And it's like it's just a number, right? It's just an age. I mean,
it's just an age.
I'm a little bit bitter because.
No, do you know the thing about the older people stat? I would like to believe that's true, but it does sometimes, because I've obviously been exposed to that in 100 different interviews over the last 5, 6 years.
Yeah.
And it sometimes comes across to me a little bit like a Hallmark card, feel good about yourself thing. I'm not saying it's not statistically true. I'm just wondering what the metric and the measure for success is. I mean,
I can believe it because there are a lot of successful companies out there that most people will never hear of, right?
Yeah.
And what successful means, I guess, is the issue. But like,
well, if you stay alive, a lot of people would justifiably say that that is a successful entity. You are running a going concern, therefore it's a success. It doesn't matter whether you're making a million or a billion or anything else. If you're keeping yourself, it doesn't even really matter if it's profitable these days. If you can run something for years. Anyway,
and this is kind of where I'm coming from. Like, if Vito, like it feels that Vito has something, and if it does, and I mean, every chance that it won't, and somebody else will come along and eat this up, whatever. But like the initial impression is that like we're onto something here, and if I can guide it in the right direction, and I'm talking to we have enough connections with Tito that some really influential people would potentially use Vito, and then we might. Take off. We might. And if that happens, people will. If that happened, people are like, "Who's this guy that was able to do this so quickly?" And it's like, it's literally, I've spent 10 years building a company that only recently got over a million in revenue. Like, and most people will have never heard of me. Most people won't have heard of Tito. Most people like will just. And I consider Tito a successful business, and I think that a lot of people in any situation would be very happy to have and run a company like Tito, but it's not like an interesting, it's not a newsworthy business.
Well, most people in the Irish tech industry who know anything, certainly who know anything about the web end or the online end of the Irish tech industry would probably know who you are. I would submit to you.
Well, thank you.
I mean, years ago, you would have crossed paths quite a bit with Paddy Cosgrave, for example.
Yeah. Sorry, that was the wrong noise.
No, but I mean,
we went to college together.
Yeah, you went to college together, and then there was, but not just Paddy Cosgrove, but there were sort of figures around that sort of time, and I remember Tito being one of the services, one of the flagship, one of the services that, you know, types who were around and who were kind of going place at that time were either trying or they were using.
Yeah, I always thought so. I thought what we were doing was cool, but I'm specifically talking about just people never really wanted to write about Tito. Or people never really thought the stuff that I thought was cool, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah. I crap my pants when RubyConf ran their tickets through Tito, right? Ruby is a language that powered the last 10 years of growth in the internet. Like, Twitter is written in Ruby, Intercom's written in Ruby, GitHub's written in Ruby. Mm-hmm. All these huge billion amazing companies are written in Ruby, and a team of three or four people from a basement office in Mount Street is providing the platform that they do their ticket sales, where like every single one of the most important people in the Ruby programming language that powers these billion-dollar companies is going to this conference that whose tickets it's in St. Louis, it's in San Francisco, it's in Missouri, it's in Indiana, and they're buying their tickets on Tito. I thought that was cool, but damned if I could ever convince a journalist that was cool. An Irish journalist anyway.
Yeah, I see you're an Irish journalist. Yeah, I can see the problem there. I hope you were married or partnered up at that point, because it's not the greatest chat up line in the world, you know. Do you know my business powers?
My wife is the most patient and loving and kind individual you'll ever meet, and she had to endure a lot of that level of nerdism.
Well, more power to your wife.
My kids are gonna be indoctrinated. Absolutely, all the power to her. She's great. we had other cool things. Like, we had cool. That was the Ruby world, and we had cool events in the design world. And again, like, it just felt like the design world. This was people who were on like the CSS working group, people who were designing browsers, people who were building the design systems that Hillary Clinton would go on to use. Mm. They were going to the cool conferences that they were going to, where they were, Tito was doing the tickets. And again, nobody seemed interested. Now, years later, I would get podcast slots on really, really high profile slots like that. And I would be a guest on podcasts by people who were really influenced in that space. So, like, I definitely see that we were doing something good, and my sphere of influence was there. But it was never all that interesting, I guess.
Well, one of the other things that you did that was quite influential among the target audience, and which was very highly spoken of among the target audience, was UL Conference.
Right. Yeah.
And UL,
similar thing.
UL, for any non-Irish listeners who are still marveling at my mid-Atlantic accent at this point, UL is the Irish Gaelic for Apple. And that, as I recall, was primarily the focus of that conference. I know there were, because I knew some of the people around the town who sort of swore by it. But it was kind of understated. It was very lo-fi. Got some great speakers, as I recall, but very lo-fi.
Yeah, absolutely. I never could quite figure out how to make money or to get more people to come. And it wasn't for specific lack of trying, but I guess because it was small and niche, that's what made it great, I suppose.
In that particular world, like, I can see the problem there, because take for any Apple fans listening, if you take a guy like Gruber, for example, who would be regarded as one of the deities of Apple commentators, if he went to speak at something in the U.S. in California, you could sell those tickets for a fair bit of money, or he would certainly be a draw to a conference. If he came to Ireland, there probably would be maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people who would be interested that he was coming, and maybe a fraction of that who would pay good money.
200 came, right? Yeah, and that's what we got to. Like, yeah. I did work it out that we got about 1% of the 10% of the 100%.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Gruber's been really good. Gruber's been great for Tito. Like, Tito, if you go to WWDC, you obviously can't go this year, but if you went last year or the year before, WWDC, obviously Apple do their own tickets. Mm-hmm. If you go to AltConf, which is a 2,000-3,000 person event that's run across the street from the San Jose Conference Center. If you go to AltConf, ticketed by Tito. If you go to LayersConf, which is a design conference across the other street, ticketed by Tito. If you go to Jim Dalrymple doing his live show, Tito. If you go to John's show, Daring Fireball Talk Show Live, ticketed by Tito. If you go to the charity event on the next day, it's ticketed by Tito. I went 2 years ago, and it was absolutely amazing to go. And my co-founder of UL, he went to WWDC after organizing UL, And he definitely came back feeling like, kind of like, whatever, at least entourage to royalty. And I went to San Jose and I was by myself and I was feeling a little bit sad for myself. And I walked up to I was crossing the road and somebody from Ool walked up and she had her baby. And I was like, hey, Steffi, how's it going? Then Jeremy Burrs, the founder of Emojipedia, walked past as we were standing chatting. And he was like, oh, Paul, how's it going? Is it you coming to Marco Arment's podcast tonight? And I was like, no, I don't have a ticket. But the tickets were being done by Tito. So Jeremy texts me like 5 minutes later. He's like, hey, I asked Marco. Yeah, you can come tonight. And I'm just like, this is kind of cool. This is kind of cool. It's exactly what you're talking about, where it means nothing walking down Dame Street, but it certainly made me feel great. There was another moment at WWC where John walked past and everybody's head turned because he walked past with his entourage of mostly people that I'd met through Ool. And I felt really sad. I just felt really sad because I guess John missed me. And I was like, oh, John, oh, I do know you. Later that night, he texted me. He's like, hey, come down to the bar. And then the night after his show, like we ended up drinking in this dingy dive bar in San Jose, going through his notes from the show where he had been interviewing these two top Apple executives, and he called me out by name in the show with there was 1,000 people in the venue and these two Apple execs listening to him thank me. And I was just like, I was sat next to Cable Sasser from Panic. And they're a really influential company. You probably know them now through this really popular game called Untitled Goose Game. Cable's the guy that basically runs the company that made that happen, and he came over and randomly sat next to me, and John called him out because it was the day that the App Store had relaxed their rules, and Cable, he'd announced that Panic were going back into the App Store, and John called that out, and Cable was like, oh, I can't believe that you called me out in person on stage. And he was looking at me and was like, oh, he was so embarrassed. And like literally 2 minutes later, John focused on me and Cable was like, oh, cool. And it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And that, like, definitely, like, I don't resent any of the I'd much rather have that than ever be I don't know, recognized for what I did in Dublin.
I can hear it in your voice, and I can't blame you at all. I mean, the funny thing about those Apple events, I've been to WWDC a few times as well. By the way, the last time I was there, I bumped into one Irish guy randomly, a guy called Derm Daly, who you probably know from Tapadoo, literally on the
street. He's my co-founder at Ool.
There you go. Indeed he was, yeah. On the street, outside. I ended up taking a picture of him and he used it as a profile pic on Twitter after that. Nice. Right there on the spot.
Hi, Dermo.
And anyway, but those Apple events can be absolutely manic for in nerd heaven. Not at WWDC, but at one of the iPhone launches. It was the year before that. And there's what happens is in the big new Apple Park, whatever, I can't remember what they call it, their new ringed headquarters. Park. Yeah. There's a big sort of mixed zone before the thing begins. And there'd be quite a lot of senior Apple executives, you know, floating around. You'd recognize most of them instantly. But I ended up standing beside Woz for, you know, a couple of minutes and just got chatting to him about stuff. And his actual partner, who is also kind of his PR manager now, was, you know, organized a line of people. And it was kind of painful because really most of what the people coming up and asking him things, it was mostly about jobs, mostly about Steve, you know. And now he's used to it. He's used to handling it all, but there's something kind of triste about that, you know. There's something where I remember thinking, I don't want to be the journalist who goes up and asks him about Steve Jobs, you know. I just don't. So I didn't. Yeah. I just stood back and
I never considered that. Yeah.
So maybe
this kind of speaks to the theme of what I'm saying is that, like, I'm sure Woz thinks that everything he's working on right now or everything he's doing right now is cool, independent, and he wants people to ask him about that stuff. But of course, people go for the angle.
But it also speaks to the original thing that we're talking about that I was going to ask you about, and that is the purpose of a conference and how it compares with a virtual conference. Because when you talk to a lot of people who pay to go to conferences, one common thing that they say, it's not the most important thing, but it's an important thing, is that they're not necessarily going there to listen to the keynotes or to, you know, to wonder and who and not. A lot of them are going there for the offsite meetings, to meet mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. Who mm-hmm. they wouldn't mm-hmm. get a chance yeah. to. And it's just because yeah. an event and everybody's going to be there. So that has struck yeah. me with a structural and a fundamental challenge that virtual conferences have. Is there any way that they can replicate that kind of experience?
No, absolutely not. I'm operating under the assumption that in-person is sacred and will always be sacred. And imagine when you're allowed to hug people again, how much more you will appreciate in-person.
Would you know, do you think so? Because I think when this pandemic is over, I think half of us are going to go mad and be like sort of orgy style sort of, hi, how's it going? And like hug as many people as you can. I think the other half are now going to be inculcated with germaphobe tendencies and get away from me. You know, I honestly think that's going to happen.
Half the world is still 4 billion people.
That's true.
There will always be, the markets will, even if it's, it doesn't matter what it is.
There'll be a lot of people
to
hug.
The notion is that, the notion is like, so one of the investors in Tito is Tom Preston Werner from GitHub. And I've been telling the story more freely over the last year or so that it wasn't the first time I met him. Was it? Maybe it was. The first time I remember hanging out with him was at a conference called JSConf EU. It was in 2009. Mm. And he came to the after party of JSConf EU. And Jan Leonard, who I had met in Dublin after setting up a co-working office with Eamon Leonard and Owen McCabe, and that's another long story. I had met Jan through that. And Jan trusted me. He said, Paul, can you look after the GitHub guys? And Eamon and I, we did what Irish people in these contexts generally tend to do, and we rose to the occasion. And we stayed out until 7 a.m. the following day with the GitHub folks. Our flight was at 11. We got a 2 hours sleep or whatever. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend that the level of drinking and silliness that went on. I was much younger, obviously, than I am down there. But it made the start of the relationship very, very organic. And I think that you can build strong relationships online, but you cannot have experiences like that. And I'm a huge advocate now for abstinence and booze not being the center of our social relationships and looking at alternatives. And I don't know if you've been to the Virgin Mary Bar in Capel Street. I absolutely love it. So I want to say this in the context that I love alcohol and I love abstinence, and I don't think that alcohol is required to have great in-person experiences.
Paul, have you invited Jesus into your life?
I'm saying it specifically.
Sorry, you're winding up to that.
I really want to be specific about it because I went to the Virgin Mary, I guess a couple of months ago, and I had a drink. And I've got kids now, right? And for kids, you have to have bedtime. You have to be able to get up at 7 a.m. And if you go for pints with a journalist in particular, you find it difficult to struggle. So I was able to go and have after work drinks with a colleague. We had a really great conversation. We had two drinks each. It felt exactly like going out for a few drinks, and there was not a single tip of alcohol. I got two grown-up cocktails. They were wonderful. So I'm just saying that I'm not advocating for going to conferences and meeting future billionaires and going and getting drunk with them, but that is what I did, and I don't think that that particular experience is replicable in an online setting. But I do believe, because we have Facebook and we have Twitter and we have YouTube and we have Tube and and we have all these nascent social networks and all these nascent online interactions and nascent online experiences, I do think that great, great social interactions and great relationship building is possible online. It's just different, right? And that's what I'm focusing on. I'm focusing on the notion that in person is sacred. You can't replace it. You can't mirror it. And it's misguided to attempt to replicate it in an online experience. But just like a combustion engine gets you from A to B and an electric engine gets you from A to B, and maybe it's the wrong analogy, but they're fundamentally different things doing they're fundamentally different, or fundamentally the same, but doing it in a different way, I guess. Or maybe multimedia is a better example. That, like, you go to the cinema and you listen to some music, and there's lots of different contexts that you can do that in, and there's lots of different ways that you can gather to listen to those different things in. And these are all the elements that make up the online experience. Like, it's a combination of broadcasting, it's a combination of cinema, pre-recorded, actual live, pretend live. There are loads of analogs down through broadcast and media history to bring into it. So it's just a different medium, but I don't think that it's not, you cannot replicate the in-person experience, and I'm adamant about that point. Doing that creates a different constraint, and then it's within that constraint that I think that really, really interesting new models will come out of.
And I suppose we've got a few months anyway for that to bed down. This is the best ever test base for that, if that is to actually work. I'm personally fascinated by how relationships, business relationships and personal relationships will evolve during this, because I think you're dead right. There's a different set of sensibilities and skills as well to in-person, right, and online. I mean, it's just different. And I think if you get to know somebody, or if you're working with somebody closely remotely, it's definitely a different, it's a different framework, and different tone, a different atmosphere, maybe even different outcomes to in-person connection. I'm fascinated to see how that works. So what's next now, before we wrap up, what's going to happen now with Vito, do you think?
Yeah, so I put a month of just like staying up late, silly late, and still having to get up at 6:45 for the kids. Mm-hmm. So I'm effectively a zombie right now. So I got a bit of a sleep last night, but I'm probably just going to go to bed. So immediately I'm going to get some sleep.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean in the next hour. Yeah, I meant.
I know. But it leads up nicely to the punchline that I haven't been this tired since that time with Tom Preston Werner in Berlin.
Oh, right. Okay. That was a very, very good long wind up. Go on.
Oh, it just hit me. The next is to find our USP, right? So we've built a YouTube and a kind of an online thing, and there's Twitter, and we've stolen ideas from bits, and we've wrapped it up in our intent that we want to be privacy focused. So everything is going to have an inbuilt code of conduct. We're going to build really strong moderation tools. We're going to make sure that people feel safe, because safety is really, really important in online. And we know that all of the platforms that I've mentioned are subject to significant abuse, and I want that to be not in question from day one. So the focus is on communities and community organizers, and community organizers having control over their community. So if there are bad actors, that they oughtn't be able to get in, and if they do get in, well, then they ought to be able to get kicked out really quick, really, really easily. And I don't know how we're going to do that, but we're certainly going to put a lot of thought into it, and from day one, because it's fundamental. It's fundamental to the way I'm thinking about it and the way I'm thinking about communities. And so that leads me then to this notion of community. So there is a bit of tension, like, do you promote the video technology? And I'm inclined to say that the video technology is sort of interesting, but we have Netflix and we have YouTube and we have SkyQ and all this. So, like, broadcast is its own thing. And we have Twitter for that kind of thing. But what we don't have is ephemeral networks. We don't have, like, the ability to follow a bunch of people temporarily for a few days. I mean, we've got mute on Twitter or whatever. So I'm thinking about it along those lines. Like, how do you maximize the your connection with this ephemeral group, which is what makes, that's one of the things that makes conferences great, that can be implemented online, that you have 100 new best friends for 3 days, right? And at a conference is 3 days, but online it could be 3 weeks or 3 months. So the other thing that online doesn't require is a venue. So the notion of stuffing a bunch of content into 3 days when everyone consumes all in a tizzy is different. So I'm definitely gonna think about bringing in those notions of seasons and content spread out over time, and discussions happening in between sessions, because how interesting is that? That, like, at a conference you have to think fast, and then you go home to think about it. But what if the conference was spread out over 10 weeks? But then we also have an analog to that, which is a course, or going to college. And sometimes you feel like you're reinventing. But what it really is that there is already a load of pre-existing models to build on. And then the second piece is that the video is interesting, but also the web platform is really interesting. And I feel like presenting a stream of video, whether it's pre-recorded or live or whatever, that's just television. And television doesn't have the luxury of having a web browser. And web browsers these days are amazing things. Mm. So a trite example for immediately is closed captioning, right? So closed captioning is usually on the screen or off the screen. But what if you could have your closed captioning open in a different window or a different screen or whatever? What if you had control over the captions? And what if you could maybe edit them and submit edits? Or the web lets you do two-way, and it lets you do customization in ways that television and broadcast doesn't do when it's just a broadcast stream. So I'm really interested in taking full advantage of the web platform. And one of the things I've noticed is when big companies do things with the web platform, you're like, oh, they're just using WebSockets and some HTML, clever HTML CSS to do that. Can you just do that? Mm. And what I've learned is, yes, you can just do it. And most people aren't doing it because nobody has done it yet. It's not because it doesn't work, and it's not because it's not a good idea. It's that good ideas haven't been done yet. So you have to be able to take a leap of faith to try them. And there has never been a better time to implement fun things and joyful things and delightful things using the web. And there's an awful lot of tools like Glitch, which is a social network built around code. CodePen, we had the founder of CodePen on our event on Tuesday. And CodePen is another kind of social code sharing thing. And people do such amazing things on there. And they do things with the web that you'd never think possible. Like people do art with CSS. They do animations. They do poetry. They do all sorts of amazing things. And these are just little ephemeral snippets that live and exist outside of all the big networks that we know. There's so many cool things that the web can do that only really nerds know about. And I'm so excited to sort of dip into that and figure out if there's interesting ways to do interesting things by exploiting that. And I've always been really up to date with what the web can do, but I've never had a chance to put it into something. And this, I feel, is my chance.
Well, if any of our listeners want to go and give it a look, you can visit veto.community and you can sign up for, I think you need to request an invitation there. I did earlier on, actually. So I'm going to wait for my...
Sweet.
It tells you to wait for further action. So Paul Campbell, the founder of both Tito and Veto and Ulconf and other things, thank you very much for joining the podcast today. And that is all we have
time
for.
Thank you so much. Sorry.
No. This is... It's okay. You can keep talking.
It was so fun. I wasn't expecting it to be so fun.
So that is all we have time for this week, folks. So for me, Adrian Wecker, the tech editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent, we'll be with you same time next week. Bye-bye.